from San Francisco. Welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn.
If someone wants to spread a virus, one of the ways to do it is to attach the virus to a coveted piece of retail software and then offer it as a pirated file.
Computer viruses. Are they scary or aren't they? Ernst Couch is the publisher of Crypt Newsletter, a publication aimed at virus writers, antivirus writers, and the computer security industry. The newsletter actually publishes the program instructions to new and interesting viruses. It's not illegal, but is it responsible?
It may only take 6 months to learn how to write a good virus if you are a clever and talented programmer. It only takes 1 day if you have the source code and want to change it to do something a little different.
Does responsible use of personal computers essentially protect you from the harm of viruses? John McAfee is founder of McAfee Associates, a leading manufacturer of antivirus software. As chairman of the Computer Virus Industry Association, he predicted substantial consequences from the Michelangelo virus. And now, Moira speaks with Ernst Couch.
Ernst, I think the general impression that people have is, I don't know what a computer virus is, but I know it's bad. What exactly is a computer virus?
Computer virus is just another computer program. It generally requires one or two things that you wouldn't expect to find in a normal computer program. That is, it has to be able to search out another executable bit of code. It has to be able to duplicate itself and attach to that code in some manner, so that when that code is executed, the computer virus will execute first, take control of the machine, and repeat the whole process. That executable code can be in any type of operating platform. All it has to do is meet those requirements.
Now, I'd like to go a step further to try to understand one, and there was a particular example in your latest newsletter, which I think just about any IBM PC user can understand, or anybody who uses MS-DOS. And that's what I'm calling this .com virus.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about how that works.
Oh, which one was it?
It was the one that normally if you type a command in on your IBM PC, on your command line,
yeah.
The first thing it will look for is a file in your directory with that command with the extension .com.
Was it a direct action virus, or which means when you type the infected file or the virus, it goes out and actively searches, or was it a resident virus which goes?
I don't know. You're going to have to explain all
that.
Latest. Let me explain the one I was thinking of,
right,
and then maybe you can address it. Tell me what it is. That basically what the virus would do, what the operating system does is the first thing it looks for when you type a series of letters and your command line is a file with the command line .com.
Right.
And if it doesn't have a .com, it then goes to the command line, that series of letters .exe. Now, most people, or many people, could find out pretty quickly that their executable programs, the ones they're executing on, will have the name of the program .exe, and that's what your compiler and linker puts out as an application program that anybody would write. Many of us have wrote millions of these things. And so what the virus did is it went out and it found programs that were listed in the directory under .exe.
Yeah.
And then it created another program.
Oh, companion virus.
The companion virus, that's it, with .com. Now, .com stands for command line or commands, so that you could put some commands in there like copy this file, do this, do that, all the standard MS-DOS commands. And what it would do is do a series of commands under .com, and at the very end then call up the command .exe.
Mm-hmm.
So you typed your normal string of letters in to get your program, and it looked like it executed your .exe file because you didn't know any better, but it in fact first went to the .com, and that was automatically generated by this little computer virus. Now, is that's called a companion virus.
Yeah, because it creates some people prefer the term spawning virus in the technical community, but I tend to refer to them as companion viruses because the virus duplicates itself and copies itself as a companion to your application, your word processor, whatever. And as you said, it renames, the virus is a COM file structure. And your application, often like WordPerfect or something like that, would have an .exe extent. Now, the virus copies itself alongside that .exe file, except it renames itself with the exact same name, and the extent is now COM. And because of the rules of DOS, when you type your command on the command line to execute the file of the program in interest, it will search and load a .com file before it will load a .exe file. Since the virus has taken that place, it has duplicated itself and renamed itself as that file, the virus will load first. It will execute, and then it will hand off to the .exe file, which will operate, in best cases, seamlessly, so that no one will know what has transpired. Generally speaking, companion viruses of this nature copy themselves into your directory with a hidden attribute set. So doing a normal directory command, you won't see that file there, but it's there.
That's right. That was another thing I saw, that the .com, that the file created .com had certain attributes such that when you do your standard DIR, you'd never see it. And so that it could be there. You could, if you knew what to look for, you could
find
it.
That's right. It's not that transparent at all. Most people have elaborate menued shell programs now which show them all the files in their directory, whether they're hidden or not. And
if you happen to go
a companion
into Norton,
virus would immediately show up like, in that manner.
Uh-huh. And so one of the things that this virus might do while it's executing in the .com mode is go look for another .exe file that didn't have a .com and generate itself again.
That's right.
So if you just did that once every time it was executed, and the first file you found was WordPerfect, and you used that all day long, you'd be propagating yourself all over the system pretty quickly, and you'd never know if you really weren't
looking.
That's
right. If it's a seamless virus that doesn't hang or have some untoward bug in it, it would operate in a manner that most people would not notice its presence on the machine.
On my way over here, someone said, well, what are you going to talk about? And I said, well, computer viruses. And they said, well, isn't that illegal? And I said, well, actually, it's not. It's not illegal to write a virus, and it's not illegal to exchange viruses. But at a certain point, it does, the use of a virus becomes illegal. And can you tell us where that is?
Well, the law exists, and I'm not word for word cognizant of it.
Sure.
But what it boils down to is any bit of executable code that a user might place on another person's machine directly with the intent of causing harm, and which does produce harm, is illegal and can be prosecuted. That includes viruses, that includes booby trap programs, logic bombs, time bombs, anything of this nature. And that's actionable, but the actual production of viruses isn't illegal. The storage of viruses isn't illegal. The discussion of viruses isn't illegal, simply because viruses, when you really get down to it, are just another piece of software, and it's not illegal to produce software.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Ernst Couch, publisher of the Crypt newsletter, the newsletter for computer virus writers, antivirus writers, and the computer security community. Ernst, your newsletter, the Crypt newsletter, is published electronically, and you also publish this, within it, you publish the source code to viruses. Do you come under criticism for publishing source code?
That's always been a controversial issue, yeah. Anyone who publishes the source code, the complete source code of viruses, comes under criticism for doing so, and the general tone of the criticism comes at printing and publishing commented virus code serves no purpose other than to put commented virus code into the hands of people who would misuse it. And with those kind of tools available, it becomes relatively simple to alter that code to a different virus which is not currently covered by antivirus scanning technology, or which has routines in it which make it more destructive, more nefarious. And that is the general gist of the criticisms that are always leveled at that. So
it's kind of a difficult situation, because we were just sitting here talking about the companion virus, and while many people who don't program would say, well, I can understand how it could get in my system and propagate, most people who do program say, well, gee,
yeah,
I could write that. That's not a big deal. I mean, I could get that out. And it's not that hard to write a virus. And so it's a matter of thinking about it and being motivated about it. So it's a question of, well, if we don't talk about it, it will go away.
No, it will never go away. I mean,
a little too easy.
as long as we're going to have computers and executable code, you'll always have viruses, and you'll have programs which operate in a manner which some people consider illegal. I hate to use that word, but other than that, you know, we'll just say that.
Do we really have a profile of who is a typical virus writer?
Well, I don't know if there's there are some stereotypes which circulate around, and the stereotypes fit some segments of the virus writing population, and the kind of things that you'll see in the vulgar news media will encompass the angry young man, the programmer who's out of work in a country which has terrible economic and political repression. And those are two of the very common stereotypes that I've seen. But that doesn't begin to fill the bill for the types of people that program viruses. I mean, there are a number of published books that and there are not dozens of them, but there have been books published by computer programmers that have virus code in them. I don't know if you would they certainly don't fall into any of those categories.
Well, you yourself have a PhD in chemistry.
Right. And I don't fall into the category where I'm an angry young man, or with an axe to grind, or I come from a politically repressive country where computer science majors aren't properly appreciated and underemployed, so I'm going to use all that technical education that I've been given to generate viruses, which can theoretically spread around the world and take my message of discontent with me. Neither of those
you don't
categories
fit in either one of those
actually
stereotypes.
Apply. No.
Well, part of the problem is that it's very difficult to figure out who these people are, all communicating electronically, so you're not exactly meeting them, and if they give a name, you don't exactly know what if that name is right or not. So there's a limited. My point is there's a limited amount of information about who these people are, and yet you don't need a tremendous amount of specialized skill to do it. So the candidate population is an extremely large population.
Yes, I'd say that anyone with a bare working knowledge of assembly language should have, by this point in time, a vague notion of how a virus operates and can write a virus. Writing viruses in higher languages is more difficult, simply because the higher languages don't get down on the low level and aren't as agile on the machine as ones that are strictly coded in assembly language. But companion viruses, which we've discussed, are easily written in higher languages. And therefore, someone even with just the knowledge of C or Pascal could write a virus.
Well, certainly anyone who had a couple of years of computer science in college would certainly be able to, and there are just...
Well, you don't even have to have a couple of years of computer science, you know. I mean, that restricts it almost to the people who have gone to school and taken computers in a formal sense.
Right. What I was trying to characterize for people is like, well, gee, I wouldn't know any of these people. There can't be that many. There are so many people who have a couple of years of computer science out there. It kind of to give you an idea of the base population who are fully capable of doing that, I think is sort of where I was going. Most high school students could write them without blinking.
Yes, we.
That's been my personal experience.
I see a lot of people of high school students who are very interested in computer viruses.
A little too interested in computer viruses. Now you were mentioning earlier about Eastern European. There's a very famous Bulgarian named the Avenger.
The Dark Avenger.
Dark Avenger. See, I didn't get the name right. Who is this person, and what are they doing?
Well, the Dark Avenger is a Bulgarian virus programmer, and I think, and there are quite a number of viruses which have been attributed to the Dark Avenger, and that's rather well established at this point, and. Conversely, there was a Bulgarian virus researcher by the name of Veselin Bonchev, and he's probably been the Dark Avenger's best publicist simply because he's made something of a career of lecturing on the nature of the viruses produced by the Dark Avenger. And the Dark Avenger has produced a series of rather sophisticated viruses and one or two and a tool which makes other viruses more sophisticated, and that's attained a lot of publicity.
Okay, Ernst, how do you stay one step ahead of the antivirus writers?
It depends. I mean, there's been an explosion in antivirus software in the past year, and there's a whole spectrum. There's incompetent designers of antivirus software. There are people who do a really good job but haven't been in the ballgame very long. And then there are the people who have been there since the very beginning, and they have varying degrees of excellence associated with them. And I would think that if you're a virus programmer and you're strictly outwit antivirus software developers, then the only ones worth targeting are the ones which have the largest retail profile or are the most frequently used programs in the country where you're writing viruses. So in the United States, that means McAfee Associates Scan, and it means you have to deal with CentralPoint antivirus products and Microsoft antivirus products.
Who really is susceptible to viruses?
I would think that people who are probably most liable to come in contact with viruses are individuals who work in an area where there's a lot of travel of disks in and out of a pool of machines used by many people. For example, a computing lab, you know, or even a business workplace where there's a lot of take home of this and that and bring it back in and put it in the machine. For example, like a copying or service in a city that allows you to bring in data on a disk. If their computers become infected with something like the stoned virus, as soon as you put your disk in their machine and read it, your disk will have the stoned virus on it, and then you take that home. And now you have a disk with the stoned virus on it. What happens on that depends on what you do. If you're in a situation where someone is, what I like to say, obsessively, compulsively acquiring pirated or even software and downloading it into their home, they stand a chance of occasionally running into a virus and bringing it into their home. This is a more recent development, I think, simply because it's been my experience that there's a large segment of the teenage and college age population cognizant with computers that likes to just acquire huge quantities of software, whether they use it or not.
Even professionals. I'll go into any group of engineers or programmers, and out of maybe 6, 7, 8 programmers, there'll be one person who is really into collecting all different kinds of software. And you, any programmer out there will tell you this, or any person who works around people with computers, which are becoming more and more prolific, they're really fascinated, and they're always loaded up with something. And they usually also have a laptop that they bring between home and work and wherever they are. I mean, and that's really only been in the last couple of years you could do that. So there's people who are highly paid professionals are just fascinated by all the software.
Yeah, but you also have to consider, the accumulation of the software by itself isn't what does it. For example, it's where you get the software, and the sources you get it from. If the people are just not very careful about the files they look at and where they get them from, then a virus can sneak by and duplicate itself rather successfully by human help or by itself. I mean, if someone wants to spread a virus, one of the ways to do it is to attach the virus to a coveted piece of retail software and then offer it as a pirated file. A lot of people just suck that in. That would be one way of ensuring the spread of a virus. For example, Microsoft products have a history of always showing up. Their beta stage is always showing up on pirate bulletin board systems. The operating systems like DOS 6, DOS 5, Windows. DOS is very easy to hide a virus in one of the programs that comes with that.
Mm-hmm. Why do people write viruses?
Well, there would be a lot of reasons, I would think. There are the programmers, the angry young men, the high school student or the college student who wants to create some mischief in his school or something like that. There are people programming viruses at this point that I've seen that simply like the challenge. At this point, there's a lot of controversy and interest associated with virus. So whenever there's controversy, some people will be attracted to that and will write viruses to show that they can do it and to be part of that and to be able to get involved in the discussion. So I see people who are programming viruses for that reason. There are other people who program viruses because they're virus collectors and they have large collections of viruses and they like to maintain trade with other people, and it's convenient for them to program a new virus occasionally so that they can use it in trade or gain a reputation in virus trading circles. And
so
we're talking
elitist
about the underground here. I've seen two examples of software developers who have developed in-house testing viruses that they bragged about to me and shown me, for their own purposes. They say, these viruses haven't gone anywhere but here. But yes, they program viruses. I would think that's become
sort of a fascination.
A fascination. Also, it may be a useful tool for you to program your own virus to try and poke a hole in your own software, or at least just try and work out some principles which you've worked out yourself. I mean, it's a lot easier to write your own code and then operate something where you know exactly what went into it.
Well, I have to say that at certain times, just in this conversation, you're saying, well, you have to be careful about this or the size, the scanner will find it. And I'm thinking, well, you could make a separate file. And it's like, wait a minute, what am I doing? Am I, designing viruses? It's like there is this impulse to, as a programmer, to try to figure out how to get around or how to do something, because that's what you do all.
Well, that's curiosity. That's human nature, isn't it? It's kind of it becomes mixed with curiosity and an intellectual pursuit. Why shouldn't it be interesting?
That's right. Okay.
And it is interesting. I mean, we shouldn't even be arguing that point. Obviously, it is rather interesting. I mean, why do we have 1,800 MS-DOS viruses?
1,800?
The numbers vary depending on
sure,
who you
would
talk
know
to.
Yeah. But you can see that many different ones out there yourself.
Yes, it's become the number is becoming so large where I'm becoming disinterested in following the exact number because
right.
It's almost a full-time occupation in itself.
Who wrote Michelangelo?
I have no idea.
I don't know who wrote
Michelangelo. I mean, maybe someone else does. I don't. I think it'd be dangerous for someone to admit to have written Michelangelo's virus at this point, simply because of.
Well, it's interesting. When you were talking earlier about the Dark Avenger from Bulgaria, and these are attributed to him, I mean, we could have a permanent kind of a thing like who really wrote Shakespeare's plays.
Right.
Well, never. And
the
really
most,
know.
I mean, the most exact thing you can actually point to was an interview with the Dark Avenger, which ran in one of the virus specialty magazines. But that is recent.
That's recent.
Yeah, and so. You can still argue. You can use the Shakespearean argument. Does this guy really exist? I mean, I think he does, but...
If I wanted to go find a whole bunch of computer viruses, how would I do that?
Well, at this point, it's not very difficult. The easiest way to find computer viruses is if you're familiar with the concept of BBSing now in almost every large metropolitan area. There are countless bulletin board systems that are run from professional to semi-professional to amateur status, and they're run by people from all walks. And if you log on to the largest bulletin board systems that are the most well-advertised in your locale, you will find that there are probably dozens of sysops on that bulletin board system who also, you know, have their own bulletin board systems locally. And among them, there will be people who specialize in all kinds of mixes of programs from shareware to pornography to pirated files, and you're going to find viruses in that mix. And as soon as you find one of those bulletin board systems that has virus code and live virus files, you will find other people on that bulletin board system who are also interested in the same thing, and it branches out from there. And pretty soon you will find you'll have a list of 10 bulletin board systems, which you can call up rather easily, and look at all the viruses that you would like to look at. I mean, you don't need 1,800 viruses on a bulletin board system to get the idea about viruses. And even the amateurs will have, by sheer dumb luck, even enough samples, you know, to fulfill your curiosity about viruses or acquire of working viruses if that's what you wish.
Moira's guest has been Ernst Couch, publisher of Crypt Newsletter, a publication available only in electronic form, which serves the computer virus writers, antivirus writers, and the computer security industry. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with Dr. Moira Gunn. John McAfee founded McAfee Associates, a leading manufacturer of antivirus software. He spoke with Moira on the virus-antivirus dilemma.
McAfee Associates produces antivirus software. What does antivirus software do?
Well, there are three basic techniques for developing and using antivirus software. One is called scanning, and that is a technique of searching the system for a pre-existing infection. That is, you look for virus signatures, just like you may look for genetic sequences in biological sciences. If you find them, you know you're infected, you know what areas are infected, and you can remove them. The second technique is called filtering, and that is you look for virus-like activities. You monitor what happens in the system, and if you see something attempting to destroy your disk, to add itself to an application programmer or slow down the system, you can suspect that a virus is present and raise a flag. And the third technique is a generic technique of looking for changes in the system after a virus has infected. When a virus infects, you may not know its signature, but it will still change something. So you look at all the pieces of the system and see what has changed. And if that piece should not have changed, then you can expect a virus is present. So by combining those three techniques, you can develop a wide variety of protection mechanisms.
Okay, let's start with the scan. Now, a virus is a program, and of course, by the time it works on your computer, it's down to machine instructions. Now, are these viruses that you've picked up from you know, a known virus, and you see what the machine instructions are like, and you compare those, or?
Yes, basically that's the exact precise technique. When a virus is assembled, it turns into an executable program or a sequence of machine instructions. Those instructions must attach themselves to other parts of your system in order for the virus to live or to multiply. When it has done so, then those machine instructions exist on every program that has become infected. So you simply search every program or every executable element of the system looking for that precise string of instructions.
All the files. Now, what if, is it all the files or just the executable files?
Just the executable programs. Viruses cannot really infect non-executable files. They can affect them, that is, they can destroy them, corrupt them, but they can't infect them. Because for a virus to get control, it has to be executed. And we don't normally execute our word processing files or our letters to our boss. We execute the word processor.
Mm-hmm.
Or we execute the spreadsheet program. So those are the areas that the viruses attach themselves to.
Well, let's say I had executable programs. I had, say, 10 megabytes worth. How long would that take to scan?
With today's scanners, you can scan an entire 10 megabyte disk in about 25 to 30 seconds.
Mm.
Because, again, you're selectively choosing areas of the disk where the virus can only attach itself to. So you can ignore vast areas of pure data.
Okay, now when we talk about filter, we're talking about sort of monitoring. You mean we're having like an antivirus monitor sit there and just occasionally look? I mean, how does that work?
No, filtering is a full-time, real-time activity. A filter is a memory-resident program that monitors every activity in your system, every disk access, every memory access, every program execution. And it monitors these activities and determines whether the activity is a normal activity for that course of the events or whether it is abnormal. For example, if you run a word processor, and the first thing the word processor does is try to modify one of your other files, like your spreadsheet. That's not a valid activity. So you might immediately say, whoops, this is strange, let's raise the flag. Or if you notice that you run a program and it immediately tries to wipe out your boot sector, that also is not a normal activity. So you would raise the flag again. So you look for lists of activities which would be indicative of a virus presence. Now, it's not always 100%. You might really be doing a disk format, for example, which will wipe out your boot sector. That's up to the user then to determine whether the activity is valid or not.
So users sit there behind what the user's doing and occasionally say, oh, there could be a problem.
That's correct. And one of the problems with filters is that the science is imprecise. And throughout the day, you may get 5 or even 10 potential warnings even when you're doing normal activities. If you're doing a program compile, for example, the compiler will attempt to modify executable code. Well, you'll raise the flag. And the user knows that, oh, I'm just doing a program compile, or I'm doing a disk format, I'm modifying the boot sector. Well, that's normal. So what happens is users become habituated to pressing the continue key. This might be a virus, hit continue. So when a real virus gets in, they're so used to just saying continue that they're not even reading the messages anymore. They just hit continue, and the protection mechanism is then invalidated.
So is this a problem? Do people stop using it, or they don't pay attention, or what happened?
Well, people still use it. It's just that if you are in an environment where false alarms, and that's what these alarms are called, is very common, then the protection tends to be less valid. If you're in an environment where you are not doing program compiles, you don't do disk formats, you don't use low-level tools, you might be able to get by with a filter quite comfortably.
Uh-huh. So you have to change what you're... look at what you're doing.
You have to look at what you're doing.
Okay. Now, there's part three, which was the changes, so that if basically when you bring it up, if you have a virus-free system, some things should not change, like the program WordPerfect.
That's correct.
Shouldn't change.
That's correct. The only time WordPerfect should change is when you update to the newest version of WordPerfect. The only time that your disk partition table should change is when you repartition your disk drive. The only time that you should have a new boot sector is when you install a new version of the operating system. So if any of these areas are changing, and you have not installed a new program, or you have not installed a new operating system, or have not repartitioned your drive, then something bizarre has happened, and that is probably a virus. So these programs will run once a day, once a week, every time you reboot your system, and they will compare the current state to the original state, which we assume was uninfected. If there has been a change, then it will raise a flag and say there may be a virus here. Then you pull out your scanner, scan your system to see if, in fact, it really is a virus.
Uh-huh. Now, when it gets the copy, do you have to copy to another place on the hard disk to compare the changes?
No. The way the detection mechanism is set up, you will first check the original program and maybe do a CRC check.
A CRC check.
Or a checksum. Or
like add them all up. So
yeah,
number
or
should be
may, you may just check the size and date. But whatever, you only save a very small amount of information for each element of your system. Then when you do the compare, you read them into memory, do the checksum again, and compare that checksum with the original checksum. If it is changed, you know the program has changed.
They won't add up the same way.
That's correct.
Okay, so that's basically antivirus software. But computer viruses are changing all the time. You know, how frequently do you have to update your antivirus software?
Well, if you updated your software for every new virus, you would have to have 3 releases per day. we currently are finding between 50 and 100 new viruses every month. So we update our software every 2 months.
Uh-huh.
And we rely on the statistical spreading techniques of viruses to provide protection. That is, when a new virus comes out, it does not automatically spread and immediately spread to 100 million computers. Viruses don't work that way. They're identical to biological diseases, so that the first person to get infected, it may take 2 or 3 weeks before the second person is infected, and then another 2 or 3 weeks before 4 are infected, and then 8. Ultimately, we will have a protection mechanism in place far before the statistical chances of you getting that virus reaches any measurable percentage.
Now, when you buy, and we'll just use the McAfee antivirus software as an example, when you buy that software, are you automatically buying updates, or do you have to go in and get, I mean, how does that work?
Well, it varies from one software producer to another, but in our company, we provide updates free of charge for a 2-year period. We basically license our software and the update service for a 2-year period, and then at the end of that 2 years, you can relicense it for the next 2 years.
Ah, so basically you're getting a license so you can keep updating and staying ahead of
That's
the crowd.
That's correct. If you do not update your software, then you might as well throw it away after 6 months.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is John McAfee, founder of McAfee Associates, the leading producer of antivirus software. Who should buy antivirus software? Does everybody have a PC?
If you have a PC, you should have antivirus software. Well, the single exception is the individual who only uses his own system, never uses another system, never lets anyone else use their system, does not exchange diskettes, and only runs software that they have written themselves. In that case, you're not going to get a virus. But I don't know anyone in that category. So the rest of us really need protection. If you exchange diskettes with someone, if you allow other people to use your computing resources, if you use your modem to access bulletin boards or external networks, you run a risk of getting a virus infection, and you really should have protection.
How many PCs are out there? I mean, that would be your market, right?
That's right. It depends on who you talk to, but there's somewhere between 100 and 150 million.
100 and 150 million. How many of those do you figure have viruses on them now?
Well, that's the question that everyone would like an answer to. The problem with trying to determine the incidence of infection for any given virus is very complex. Number one, people who get viruses don't always report them. In fact, they very seldom report them. You may get a virus, you have an antivirus program, you kill it, you get rid of it, and you go on with life. You may not even tell your friend, let alone some agency that's trying to count infections. Even if you do get a virus, And you would like to report that virus, it may be that the virus has destroyed your system, so we have no way of knowing which virus it was. I mean, you got a virus, something went wrong, and we don't know. Or we don't know that it really was a virus. Perhaps you had a hardware failure. Perhaps you accidentally erased all of your files yourself. It's difficult to determine. We do know, based on the incidence of reports, that the rate of infection as reported is growing at 100% a year. Now, does that mean that people are more aware and they know who to call? Or does it mean that viruses are really spreading at 100% per year? I don't know. And neither does anyone else that I know. If you know someone with the answer, I'd like to hear it myself.
Well, how many were reported last year?
To our company.
To who?
Okay, and that's to who. See, that's another thing.
Nobody called me, but that's okay.
That's
they
right.
wouldn't have thought to.
The we receive between 200 and 400 reports per week now, which is double our reporting statistics this time last year.
Mm-hmm.
And each incident, by the way, may involve more than one machine because our primary customer base are large corporations and government agencies. So when an infection occurs in one of those organizations, it generally infects multiple machines. If it's on a network, it can be very many hundreds of machines. But we only count the incident itself. They will call and say, we had the Stone virus on our network, and multiple machines were infected. We put one mark down.
Uh-huh.
So again, no one really has a good answer at the current time.
So that if we, at a minimum, just from what McAfee knows, that we take their minimum number, 200 a week, there'd be 10,000
incidences per
year.
And each one of those would have an average of at least five machines. So we're up to 50,000 machines per year. And that's us. There are many other companies in this business. There are many other agencies that are attempting to gather statistics. So it's at least in the tens of thousands.
Your name first came to my attention around the time of the Michelangelo virus, and you were quoted, and I saw that the numbers were varying, that up to as many as 5 million computers could be infected with the virus.
Mm-hmm.
Why were you excited about the Michelangelo virus as opposed to other viruses?
The reason Michelangelo garnered so much attention last year was because prior to its activation date, which was the 6th of March, a number of very large companies had shipped out thousands of infected copies. Leading Edge Computers, for example, shipped out 10,000 computers that had the Michelangelo on it. They didn't do it on purpose. They found out about it after these machines had been shipped. So there were at least 20 to 25,000 copies of the virus that had been distributed to the general public. That's a fairly catastrophic event. To have happened all at once. I mean, it's one thing for virus to enter the public domain and over a period of years infect a few thousand machines. It's another for, within a period of a week, 25,000 people to have infected systems.
How did they figure out that it had the virus on it? This is
before
it was going to go out.
No, it was after it went out. They didn't know until the systems had been delivered, and what happened is people started getting the systems, scanning them, and finding the virus.
So they called Leading Edge back.
And they called Leading Edge, and then Leading Edge checked their master diskettes and found, yes, indeed, we had the virus. We didn't know we had the virus. We infected all of our systems that went out the door. I mean, that's typical when we distribute viruses on prepackaged software. The software developer or producer does not intend to infect anybody. It just happens.
So that the rule of thumb that says if you go into a store and you buy a shrink-wrapped hardware and software package, you won't have a virus. That ain't necessarily
true. That's absolutely not true. There have been even very large companies other than Leading Edge. Novell, 2 weeks after Leading Edge, distributed over 1,000 copies on one of their update diskettes. Novell is the world's largest network supplier. So if Novell can do it and Leading Edge can do it, you know that anybody else can do it. So the rule of thumb is when you buy shrink wrap software, unpack it, and the very first thing you do is scan it. And then and only then should you install it and use it.
How could a Leading Edge or a Novell, and I know that there are others, how could they, with all their professionals on staff, how could they have a virus?
In most cases, it's because the QA department is not keeping up with the antivirus updates.
Well, that would explain them not finding it. But
that's
how
correct.
Did it get in?
Oh, well, it's kind of like how did you get your last cold? You didn't intend to. You practice you wash your hands. You know, you are aware of the transmission of viruses, and yet you get colds. I'm sure. I had one last year. I had one year before that. It's simply the way the virus works. It is designed to spread from one machine to another. So if you have a company with thousands of computers like Leading Edge does, that's a massive host base. If you have a company with 1,000 employees, you are guaranteed that some of them are going to get the flu, are going to get a cold. It's the same thing with computers. Simply because for each computer, you have a user, and that user moves. He goes from work to home, he takes diskettes, he brings them back. Or if you get diskettes in from your customers. If you're a large computer manufacturer, a user buys your computer, has a problem, you say, well, copy these files onto a diskette and send them in, we'll analyze them. If that user's infected, you now have an infected diskette in your shop. So it's impossible to keep a virus out of large corporations.
Now, these viruses have been primarily IBM PC-based. Why haven't there been a lot of Macintosh viruses?
There's been a lot of speculation as to why IBM PCs bear the brunt of the virus burden, and I think it's because IBM PCs have the largest host base. In order for a virus to live, that is, in order for it to be successful at moving from machine to machine faster than you're able to find it and wipe it out, there must be a massive host base. There are 150 million IBM PCs, less than 12 million Macs. Also, the IBM PC has traditionally been a lot cheaper. If I'm a 16-year-old high school student and I want to write a virus and I don't have a computer, I can go and buy a used IBM PC for $200. I'd have to pay 3 to 4 times that for a Macintosh. So I think it's a combination of ease of access and size of the host base.
Target-rich environment.
Correct.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is John McAfee, founder of McAfee Associates, the leading producer of antivirus software. Okay, John, how do you stay ahead of the virus riders?
Well, you're assuming something here, that we are actually staying ahead of the virus riders.
As a goal. Pre-gotcha, you know.
The virus riders have one significant advantage over the antivirus companies. That is, when we produce a product, it becomes instantly available to anyone who wants to pay $25 for it. When the virus riders develop a new virus, we have to wait for it to infect someone and be reported to us. So they're faster. They can get our current product, take it apart, find out how it works, and then start working on their next generation to get around it. Whereas we have to wait for their next product to reach someone who will send it to us before we can take theirs apart to develop our next generation to get around theirs. So we have a slight disadvantage. The advantage we do have is cooperation. In the virus world, virus writers have to be semi-underground. You can't put an ad in a paper saying, I want to develop a brand new virus. I'd like 200 or 300 people to help me put this thing together. It's difficult. In the antivirus community, we can. We can cooperate with our competition. We can cooperate with national agencies. We can cooperate with our customers and clients in speeding up this process and in helping to develop antivirus solutions. But at 40 to 50 viruses per month, we're sort of on the edge of lagging behind, and that's just a fact of life, and I think all antivirus producers will say the same thing.
You just get on the bandwagon and you keep rolling.
You just roll.
Well, I don't shag it here, but when I was doing the research for this, I was calling around. I called a whole number of people all over the country, and on the antivirus side, it was very simple because these people are almost all employed and can say who they're employed by, and they're actually in the business or associated with reviewing mm-hmm. antivirus software.
Right.
On the virus writer side, there really is an underground. I mean,
sure.
It is an underground kind of thing. And at one point, I think I told someone I was going to be interviewing you. I didn't tell everybody, but this particular person said, for $250, I can get you McAfee's testing library. I went, this conversation has gone far enough.
But that is the truth.
And they're selling libraries.
That's correct.
And you started naming other people's software, antivirus software.
Sure.
And I just realized, my gosh, there's a complete game going on out here.
It is. It's not really a game. And a third advantage that the virus writers have is that they do not have to abide by the laws. Or not that they don't have to, is that they do not. They can and have frequently called up our own internal mail system and used hacking programs to attempt to break passwords to get into our internal mail. The same thing with our bulletin board systems. We're under constant, I hate to use the word attack, but I really don't know a better word, but constant abuse by the virus writers in trying to find out more information about what we're coming up with, in trying to make it more difficult for us to detect their software. And like you said, they even manage, and I don't know how they do it, to get our testing libraries. Now, we do exchange testing libraries with a lot of agencies, but we do a lot of it electronically. And a good hacker that doesn't mind breaking the law can tap into a number of resources to steal data transmissions. And I'm well aware that people have done that.
There are a number of publications and bulletin boards where you can go and you can get the source code for viruses and techniques for viruses. Where do you stand personally on this issue of publishing viruses?
Well, I have a vested interest in none of that happening. I have a real vested interest because every new virus that crops up costs us a substantial sum of money to develop a solution for. The publication of viruses or the transmission of viruses between agencies and corporations that need to develop solutions has to take place. I, as an antivirus software producer, really need to cooperate with, even with my competition, and with other agencies to share viruses so that we all keep on top of the current state of affairs. It makes me a little nervous when 16-year-old kids are doing that. It makes me even more nervous when source code is distributed, because it may only take 6 months to learn how to write a good virus if you are a clever and talented programmer. It only takes one day if you have the source code and want to change it to do something a little different. What makes me even more nervous are the virus construction laboratories that are available today on bulletin boards. You can download this big, massive program with a nice user interface with pull-down menus that will allow you to design your own virus. They're called the virus construction kit and the VCL.
It's the virus creation library?
It's the virus construction lab, I think.
Construction
is the name.
Lab, yeah.
And the way it works is you pull down menu items that say, here's what I want it to do. I want it to destroy the disk or erase the fat or slow down the system or so on. On the 1st of April of 1994, and I want it to display the following message, and I want this following copyright in it, and so on. There are hundreds of selections. You click on the ones you want, and then type go, and in 20 seconds you have your own custom virus. That makes me nervous.
But that's not illegal.
No, of course not. Writing a virus is not illegal. Writing a virus and surreptitiously planting it in someone's machine without their knowledge is illegal. But if I write a virus which destroys computers and I give it to you and say, Moira, here's a virus, it's going to destroy your system if you're not careful. That's legal. You can run it, infect yourself, and then that virus will ultimately spread to tens of thousands of computers. But since I didn't do the spreading, I'm perfectly in the clear. That's the problem with the current laws.
Now, where do you think the laws have to go, John?
Well,
it's a
tough issue, you know, and depending on which side you're on, you'll have a different attitude. On my side, again, I'd like to see very tough laws, because here's the problem. There is currently no disincentive to write a computer virus. None. Certainly no legal disincentive. There might be a small social disincentive. You know, people, shame, that's not very nice. On the other hand, there's a tremendous incentive for certain groups. hacker organizations. If you're, you know, an 18-year-old kid with a computer, you're technically competent. You prove your worth by being able to write a good virus, and that's what's happening. You know, it's a game, and everyone's trying to outdo everybody else. You know, hey, my virus is slicker than yours, or you're waiting for it to show up in the newspapers. That's another thing. You know, you want your virus to spread so far that it becomes known. So there's no disincentive. There's a tremendous incentive, and that's why we're having 50 to 100 of per month. This time next year, if the trend continues, we'll have 1,000 per month. At some point, it'll collapse. The antivirus community will collapse. The computer-using community will collapse. It'll have to. I mean, if there are 50,000 viruses out in the world, we will be getting 3 or 4 a day. We'll be spending all of our time trying to remove them.
So you don't see a plateau yet?
I haven't seen one yet. All we've seen is a hyperbolic curve going, you know, toward the azimuth, and it's not looking good.
When did the viruses start?
The first virus came out in January of 1987. It was a virus called the Pakistani Brain, written by two young brothers in Pakistan.
And from there, it's just...
From there, we're over 2,200 now.
Are the viruses getting tougher?
Oh, absolutely. The virus technology is intense these days. They, in fact, had these virus writers applied their talents to better causes, I think, you know, IBM would not be in the doldrums now, and we'd have a far better world. No, the virus writers have invented a lot of pretty sneaky technology, one called stealth, brand new concept, the ability for a program to turn invisible. And that was invented 2.5 years ago now. And a lot of viruses are still stealth viruses. That is, when you get them, forget it. You can't see them. You can't hear them. They are not there, even though it's like the stealth bomber. You've flashed the radar beam. You see nothing. The newest technology is a technology called polymorphism, which is a technology of self-mutation. It means that as the virus spreads, it mutates continuously so that it may infect your program. The very next program it infects, it will have absolutely nothing in common with its former self.
In terms of its capabilities of what it does.
The capabilities are the same, but the appearance is completely different. It's like a caterpillar metamorphosing into a moth or a butterfly. It's spectacular. And we have to put up with this. You know, we have to, as antivirus product developers, come up with techniques to try to find something which is constantly changing. It's the equivalent of being a police detective looking for a suspect described as a white male, 45 years old, with blonde hair, who the very next minute turns into a black 12-year-old female. That's exactly the same thing. And trying to find the suspect is becoming increasingly difficult.
Well, I can't tell from what you're saying whether you're predicting that McAfee Associates is going to have a boom business or whether you're going to be out of business.
We're definitely not going to be out of business. If the world were suddenly overrun by burglars tomorrow, the burglar alarm companies would not go out of business. They may be pulling their hair out. But we will not be out of business. It is still problematic as to what will happen 2 to 3 years from now if we do not change the legislative system.
Mm-hmm.
We can certainly keep up with the influx of viruses at its current rate. If it moves from 50 a month to 5,000 a month, we're all going to be in some problematic waters.
Moira's guest has been John McAfee, founder of McAfee Associates, a leading manufacturer of antivirus software. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans in Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Special thanks for additional facilities at KPCC-FM in Pasadena. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.